Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, welcome to Playboys, and today we are doing some Oscar Wilde. I'm the Dean, joined by both PJ and Playboy Alex, back from the...
Hello there.
We're doing the importance of being earnest.
So this is a play that I've always seen in production at every high school. I don't know why, but I just always see it having been done, or like university as well.
Right.
It's kind of weird.
So you've seen it performed?
No.
All right. You're always aware of it being performed, but you've never...
I'm always aware. Well, I'd always gotten to the school right after they'd done it.
Right.
Oh. But it's an amazing play. I loved it. I mean, what do you guys think? I think it's just, it may be trivial. It's great.
I love it. Spoilers. It's pretty good.
It's good.
I have some issues with it here and there, but I do think like it's generally quite well done.
It's very well done. I'll say one thing, because PJ, you love Woodhouse. PG Woodhouse.
Yes.
This strikes me as Woodhouse done well.
yes. Yes, it is. Yeah. It's very Woodhouse, and I love that it doesn't... because the last time I read it was 14 years ago, so I really forgot everything. And I was thinking, this is very Woodhouse-ian, act one, like especially in the middle. But then it ended a bit unexpectedly, so it was still very original. I'm surprised that you guys don't love it. This is an amazing play.
We do love it.
And especially you, Dean. Like, you know,
I love it. Oh, it's very English.
Dean
very
does
posh.
Love it.
I love
Dean
it.
Loves it.
Yes.
Yeah. I think overall it's pretty good. I definitely would, if I were to watch it, I would be laughing the entire way through it, I think.
Yeah.
Now, there's just absurd moments throughout it here and there that's like, really, all right, we're doing this. And then it ends somewhat like a Shakespearean play, where it's just wrap it up in like 2 minutes and that's
it.
Fine. But speaking of, like, you got Woodhouse, I was getting Comedy of Errors. Like,
yes.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
This is crazy. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking of Woodhouse and a Comedy of Errors the whole time I was reading it. And I did not know Woodhouse or Comedy of Errors before I read it like a long time ago. Oscar Wilde was one of the first like big authors I really got into. I read like the entire works one by one of his plays, and I really loved that one. But he's an amazing writer, I can see the resemblance of both two characters. I had the same thoughts.
If you just take out the silly bits where they, you know, they think that acronyms substitute comedy. If you take that out, then you've got a good Woodhouse play here, you know.
You know what I think about Woodhouse? Very fond of the chap.
So let's talk about who's in the play, shall we? We've got a Algernon Moncrief.
Flowers for him.
We've got a Mr. John Worthing. John, I guess going by Jack, which is the nickname for John. But also going by Ernest. More on that later. And the butler, Merriman. Not very important, but I do like the name.
The manservant, Lane.
There's Lane's the manservant. There's the Canon Chasuble, who's some kind of reverend. Doctor type.
Doctor reverend.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then we have Lady Bracknell, Algernon's aunt. We have Cecily Cardew.
Cecily, I think.
Why isn't it just Cecilia? Yeah. It's spelled with a Y. Cecily. That's really weird. Cecily Cardew and her governess, Miss Prism. And Gwendolyn Fairfax.
Basically like the daughter of Jack. How do they put it again?
She's his ward.
Ward, thank you.
So I would have thought Cecily, but anyway, but yeah, she's the granddaughter of the man who took care of John/Jack. So John/Jack is an orphan, and his parents abandoned him, and it starts off with him just being with Algernon, and talking about bun brewing. Is that a good
bun brewing.
Is that a good starting point? Because that's a key word anyway.
Yes, I overlooked it at the beginning.
Almost no meaning.
There you go. I overlooked it because I thought it was a nonsense word, but it turns out to be quite critical, actually.
Yeah, so... Yeah.
Do we want to explain what it means?
Bunbury is basically this guy that Algernon would meet, although he's not actually meeting anyone. It's him just using it as an excuse to get away. Now, this Bunbury is supposedly sick, and he goes and takes care of him, but of course he doesn't exist, and...
Yeah,
Bunburying, I don't exactly know how it's used in some, or the meaning behind it in some situations. I think it's just like Algernon trying to be a little bit smart and funny.
Yeah, it's just his way of getting away and, you know, from the world and getting up to shenanigans, things that aren't necessarily becoming of a gentleman. And it's all, you know, put it down to Bunbury. And Jack's doing the same thing with Ernest, right? He's doing things that he can then attribute to his brother Ernest instead of himself. Yeah. And that's they're both doing the same thing, actually.
So Jack goes by both Ernest and Jack. On all of his business cards, he writes Ernest and tells people that his name's Ernest, but his actual name is Jack. He says that he has a brother named Ernest who doesn't actually exist, but he can always blame things on him and make these stories up. But it's
convenient.
Convenient, but I don't know how he ever uses that brother. He doesn't
really. We just assume that these have both been going on for a while, but we don't really see much detail of them being used in the play, I suppose. Look, we open with funny scenes already, though. So Jack's going to see his friend Algernon, and they're friends, but they don't really like each other. Like, they're not very affectionate. He's kind of like, "Why are you in my house? Go away, get out of my house." He's like, "I'm staying for tea." He's like, "Oh, goodness sake, I don't stay for tea." And his aunt's coming for tea, and Jack is really in love with Gwendolyn, who is the sister, niece,
cousin,
who is cousin, the cousin
of Algernon. And exactly. My favorite scene,
Very important,
is they have a lot of cucumber sandwiches, specially prepared for the aunt. And Jack's not allowed to eat them because they're just for the aunt. But Algernon is eating them all, and then he eats them all. And when the aunt arrives, like, "I thought we had cucumber sandwiches. Like, well, I don't know what's happening." And the butler goes in on it.
Yes.
He agrees, like, they didn't have any today. Like,
yep.
I thought the butler was very Jeeves-esque. Like,
yeah,
he's so funny. I love one of his quotes later on. So Algernon says, "I'll probably not be back till Monday." Then he says, "I hope tomorrow will be a fine day, Lane." Lane says, "It never is, sir." Algernon says, "Lane, you're a perfect pessimist. My best to give satisfaction, sir."
Yes.
I just got out of it. It's funny.
There's also a nice bit where Algernon says to Lane near the beginning, like, they've got it down that we drank, you know, 8 bottles of wine at the last parties. Yes, 8 bottles of wine were used. And he says, "I don't know why the servants are always going and drinking 8 bottles of champagne, you know, when obviously it was not the servants who had drank the champagne."
Then they say it's also... Well, because you're like, if you're married, then there never is any good wine. Because,
and guys, let's talk about, hold on a second. I mean, this play was written in 1895, really, when naturalism was big in Europe, and it was all very serious. And Thomas Hardy was writing some really dark novels. And really, Oscar Wilde for me is, you know, he's famous as a dandy. He just talked. It's called The Importance of Being Earnest, a Trivial Comedy for Serious People. So it's really playing with this nonsense and farce of society. And the fact that both the countryman needs an alias to go to the city and the cityman needs an alias to go to the countryside. It's just, it's all about the absurdity of society, but always with playfulness. So I find Oscar Wilde did a great job in this play, particularly, to keep it light, almost even... I mean, it's almost like an art, the way he kept it light, especially in this time period.
And it is very light. Like, it's a very funny, very easy, very light read. Marriage is a key theme in this, and that they want to get married, but they also don't, you know, and they don't like this idea of marriage. They're saying single bachelors. And Algernon mentions that, you know, is marriage so demoralizing as that? And Lane says, "Well, I believe it's a very pleasant state, but I've had very little of experience of it, having only been married once." And this is presumably something Elrond didn't know anything about. And he's just like, well, I'm not interested in your life, Len. It's like, he just told you've been married. He's just like, ah, I'm not interested in my servants' affairs. You know, I love it.
Yeah. And they'll talk about it in other ways. Jack really loves Gwendolyn and Gwendolyn loves Jack. He says, but he also says, like, you don't think there's any chance of Gwendolyn becoming like her mother in about 150 years, do you, Algie? Algernon says, all women become like their mothers. That's their tragedy. No man does. That's his.
And then he says, important, then he says, do you always talk nonsense? And then he says, right, you never talk anything in nonsense. Well, nobody ever does, you know, like, it's just keeps repeating that it's all just nonsense.
And Algernon also says that you never deal with your own business. Jack says something along the lines of, like, you're always interested in other people's business. And he's like, well, no one would ever be interested in their own business. Like, he's not a working man. He's just a frivolous kind of bachelor, semi-aristocratic almost, just, you know.
We don't really know what any of them do.
Nothing, like, as far as I can tell.
Jack does investments. Okay.
Well, it's this vague kind of like, I mean, Woodhouse would do the same thing again with Jeeves and Wooster. I mean, Seinfeld made it big again in the 90s. This kind of like the bachelor lifestyle of what are they doing? Like this trivial, a show about nothing.
Yeah,
that's what Seinfeld said. But I mean, this is really a play about nothing. It's a play about trivial misunderstandings about names. That's all. And very important, we have to mention that, all right, that the name Ernest has to be kept. All right. So Cecily thinks he's genuinely called Ernest. And Jack says, well, would you still love me if I'm called
Jack?
No,
Gwendolyn.
Gwendolyn, sorry, excuse me, thank you. Yeah. And Gwendolyn says, no, not at all. Jack, John, such a common name. And I've been fantasizing about being with a man called Ernest.
Yes, so this scene actually appears twice. So the same scene appears with both couples. So we're skipping ahead a little bit, but Algernon and Jack with their women, this the same thing happens. So with Cecily and Algernon and with Jack and Gwendolyn, they both then present themselves as Ernest, and the women say, this is perfect, I've always dreamt of this. And then they both say, well, what, wouldn't you prefer a normal name like Algernon or Jack? And no, that's horrible. And I wouldn't do that. And the same thing happens twice.
And this is act two, right? Algernon goes, he finds out the address of Jack. Jack didn't say it to him, but he finds out the address, and Algernon goes to the country house of Jack and presents himself as Ernest, the brother of Jack.
Now, one detail we'll just pull back very slightly is because Algernon goes there and falls in love with Cecily. But before that happens, Jack actually has already proposed to Gwendolyn and been accepted, and the aunt has said no.
For the most part. She likes everything else about him except that they don't know his heritage.
He was born in a bag in a train station.
So which he freely admits to her. I was born in a bag in a train. I was found in a bag in a train station. And he freely admits it. And says, you like everything else about me? I'm being open and honest. And she says, look, I really recommend that before the season is over, you find some relatives and at least one parent.
Yep.
Because, and I love the phrase she says, losing one parent, that's tragic. Losing two is just careless.
Yeah. There's a lot of this. It's full of humor, almost every line. You know?
There really is. I love the back and forth with Algernon first meeting Cecily. Like, she's just... I feel like rude to him in a way at first, but it's also in a like witty way. Algernon says, oh, I'm not really wicked at all. Like, you mustn't think I'm wicked. She says, if you're not, then you certainly have been deceiving us all in a very inexcusable manner. I hope you've not been leading a double life, pretending to be wicked and being really good all the time. That would be hypocrisy. How dare you?
You don't remember like it. And that's the 1890s was a period leading to like modernism, and a sense of morality was really dying. Like, Nietzsche said just a few years before the play is produced, God is dead, meaning more like the values are dead. So everyone's kind of like, everything's meaningless, but all usually very dark. So Oscar Wilde is actually taking the playful part of it and making it cabaret-esque here.
An interesting thing in my book as well, kind of leading into it. So they say that a big important part about this play, it's about masking in a way. So they say that in this case, you're even some lies, small lies, they can be accepted, as we'll see later in the play. just as it's really important for like Wilde's sexuality. It could only be tolerated as long as it was kept discreetly off stage, unacknowledged, unspoken. Some things like that, which I think is very interesting look.
And Between the Lines, it's very sexual, I find, the play. It's very sexual, always, like, if you read Between the Lines.
For the time, so, yeah. Like, they're just spending time together already. Like,
I mean, they're
Cecily sets up Miss Prism to go for a walk with Chasuble or whatever his name is, you know? And she says, like, I feel the headache. You told me you had a headache coming on. You better go for a walk with the doctor there. And she's, I told you no such thing. But I think I will go for that walk, yes. And that gives them a bit of private time, you know?
So they're all very horny, the three couples. Yeah. The horny couples.
They kind of are. Yeah.
Well, to kind of go into the next thing that my book says, perfect segue, thank you. The truth is rarely pure and never simple.
Yeah.
So modern life would be very tedious if it were either, and modern literature, complete impossibility.
I do like a few of the quips as well when the aunt says things like, this is got to be later on, she says, this should be a really short engagement because we definitely don't want you to find out, you know, anything about each other before you get married. Like that would never do.
And again, talking about sex, they mention history would be boring if it weren't full of affairs. She uses a different word, but she mentioned like, well, if history weren't full of like, you know, people having affairs or be cheating their husband or wife,
right,
it would be unreadable.
Do we find Cecily to be a believable character? Because here's my impression of Cecily.
If she were a real person, I would run as far as I could get away.
So she spends her days sitting in this garden with her governess, complaining that she doesn't want to read her German grammar or her geography book. And
already that seems to be a person Dean's interested in.
Okay. Well, seems to be her entire life. But she's got this diary she writes her secrets in, but she doesn't do anything. She's got no secrets. She's very nice to Miss Prism. She wants to get this published. Her diary of memoirs that she just notes in every time someone says something to her. And she just felt very unrealistic. As soon as the first guy she sees, she basically falls in love with because she's never seen any other guys before. And she wants a bad boy, you know?
She's scary. Like, so she, in her, like, she had letters that she wrote herself as if they were from Jack's brother Ernest, who doesn't exist. And said, like, yeah, you sent me these letters, and then I canceled the engagement, and now we're actually engaged. And it's like, all right, you are a scary stalker.
No, this is convenient for Ernest, though, because he can say, well, we've been engaged already. Like, this has already been accepted, you know? But it's like, hold on. This is, you wrote the letters from me to yourself. Like, you've only met me today. This is crazy. We've gone through a breakup, you know, and got back together and everything.
I didn't mind that. I thought they were all like, well, I'd like to have tea with them and some vegan cake, you know. I wouldn't mind all that. But I mean, it's all in that universe, of course. They're all just mad in the universe.
Yeah, you would.
And hold on. Did anyone notice why all the mention of German? And he guesses she's studying German. She's not really studying German. There's love a mention of the German. Just like studying German.
I never thought, to be honest.
Wow, what about Ernest, you know, or Ernst? His name comes from Sirius in German. So the fact that's just that it is a mention. I mean, I think Oscar Wilde spoke German as well. It is always it's mentioning back to the title, the importance of being earnest, a trivial comedy for serious people. And they're always mentioning about kind of like, they always, like, the women seem very attracted about men who are very serious, but who are very aloof as well.
Right.
But they have to be serious about something, you know.
I get
the importance of being serious.
The women are definitely not supposed to be taken seriously in this.
Yeah.
I get that. It just ruins the illusion for me at times when you have her being very creepy in any other realistic situation. And then you can tell, it's weird to say this about Oscar Wilde, but if it were written by anyone else, I'd say you can tell this was written by a man. Like Gwendolyn saying, how absurd to talk of the equality of the sexes. Where questions of self-sacrifice are concerned, men are infinitely beyond us.
Well, the reason they say that is because immediately preceding that, one of the guys does make a sacrifice, doesn't he? Like he basically says that he'll do whatever she wants. He uses the lapdog thing where he'll just give up everything and do whatever she wants. And that's the reason that she then says that. And I think the men do give up than the women in this. They're more infatuated. And the women pretend to not care. And they say, you know, go over there and we don't want you in here. And then they say, any real men would have followed us in. And then they do follow them in. And they say, oh, the impertinence, they followed us in. It's like, okay, come on, stop it with the sexist hijinks, you know?
I mean, self-sacrifice, I can't say, that's definitely not.
But is it not? Is it not also possibly kind of saying the opposite? I mean, it's very paradoxical, the play. So first of all, they said, like, you know, big sacrifice. But it's not a big sacrifice to just give up your name and like, get a few drops of water on your head. I mean, it's obviously just the whole time. It's kind of like a paradox the whole time.
Well, they're willing, like, the men are willing to change their names. You know, the men are willing to change their names. Just these women love them, except for this weird whim and caprice that they don't like their first name.
Which so the men are willing another to red flag. Yeah. Do not change yourself for the women.
Well, that's the point. With. So the fact that the men
never
are willing,
that's the point. Yeah,
the men are willing to do that, and the women are just issuing demands and not giving anything back. That's why he says it's the sacrifice, and she then accepts that. Like, men are willing to give up more than we are, because we are actually not giving up anything. We're just demanding that you change your name.
Well, the point was Oscar.
If there
remember,
were a compromise,
the point of,
I get it. But
the point of Oscar Wilde, even though it's very light and trivial, he's still kind of criticizing decadency. You know, he's still kind of saying that there are no morals in the picture of Dorian Gray. It's just, that's the whole point. He doesn't have any morality, no codes, no moral coding, no values. And it's the same here. They have no values at all. No one has any values at all.
Oh, they just go around doing whatever they want.
And I see that the comedy does come from that. Like, oh, these values just went away so quickly. Even.
And it's the end of it's almost the end of the Victorian period. I mean, they're kind of fed up of that of that really conservative. They're getting out to flourish.
But let's say where the story goes to. So we end up with two people both pretending to be called Ernest to the two girls. Everyone wants to marry each other, but everyone is opposing everyone else's marriage. And
for
it to be friends.
And for a time, it is very Shakespearean, as you said, Alex. Yeah. It is very a comedy of errors-esque. And I thought it might go on, but it didn't like that. It was just for Act Two that there was some confusion. Who's Ernest? But that they do realize then who is Ernest, and then it crashes down. They realize that there
no one is
names.
Ernest, right?
Then you get the liar reveal trope, which I can't really stand the liar reveal trope. I'm very glad that in this play that it is short.
Mm-hmm.
So that is fair. I will.
They
give
forgot to do the Shakespeare, you know, three acts of transvestitism or whatever in order to get to the reveal at the end of it, right?
Well, the classical
all that. Yeah, no,
well,
stop it.
Shakespeare always does Act Four, where it just goes away from the story, and then it's resolved. Act Five, there's nothing of that, sadly.
Yeah,
it's very put down. So I thought it was good because it was unexpected. I thought it was going just a comedy of errors, but then it's something else. So the next part is,
well, they are opposing each other's marriages. The aunt is opposing everything.
Exactly. So this is Act Three now, yeah.
And it all just kind of works out because they realize
aunt very quickly accepts Cecily though. She's like, oh, she has a lot of money. Okay, you have a nice profile. I like the way you look. We could do something about your hair.
She didn't like her at all until she heard she had a lot of money, and immediately that was fine.
I can just imagine a modern interpretation. She says, you have a very nice Tinder profile, and I like that about you.
No, the biggest problem was, to good heavens, Gwendolyn. I mean, Gwendolyn. Sorry, that's one of my favorite lines from the play. anyway.
What we need to deal with is the origins of... well, not Ernest,
Jack,
but of Jack, right?
Jack John.
We find out very conveniently that it was actually the aunt's nanny or whatever, I guess, who'd left off the bag.
Miss Prism.
Miss Prism's the one who left the bag, yeah.
Before
the
she was
governess.
When she was, yeah, she was the governess.
Well, hold on a second. Very importantly, this is only discovered as Augusta happens to be there. This is the first time she's in that house and meets Jack John. And the thing is, Jack John was lost. He was a lost boy. Miss Prism, who is a novelist as well,
was also lost, right?
Yeah, she was also lost. She put the novel in the baby's, excuse my vocab. Where do you put babies?
The pram?
Don't put them in bags.
Or,
in the pram.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Not in the bag. The baby was put in a bag and the book was put in a pram, and then she lost both.
But then she disappeared and went off to this other house. And, you know, in these like small English towns, I guess no one speaks to anyone else. And they just didn't realize that like she's been the governess for the relatives up the road for the last 10 years or whatever.
So a bit of it was a bit of a Deus Ex Machina at the end, wasn't it? Just kind of let's
it
resolve.
It was. And
That's how farce works, though.
And it just so happens they find out the name that his father had that was also given to him, which happened to be Ernest.
And Jack. His first two names were Ernest,
Ernest
and Jack.
Jack.
Even though they didn't know either of those. They find it in the army lists because they're like, how would we find out his name in the army lists? Would it be around the 40s? Yes, we have that one right here. It's like,
and
of
this is where I
do.
Think, like, I feel like Oscar Wilde just said, I don't know how to end this. All right, we're going to do the Shakespearean way and just have it be random. I'm getting like Winter's Tale type ending. Let's wrap it up immediately and we're done. Now,
well, I had a really fun time
all throughout it. It's just the ending that's like, really? We're doing this? It's too sweet.
I like the ending, PJ? But I have... Yeah. No, I like the ending, but I don't like that he had to add Ernest and Jack. That's pushing it. You know what I mean? Like, just Ernest. Just Ernest, but not Ernest and Jack. And then it's like this.
I didn't mind that.
And I also have a problem. But I have a problem, though. My problem is actually more, what about there's supposed to be two Ernests? Or am I getting something wrong here? I thought Algernon had to be Ernest as well. He had to be Christian Ernest.
He just lied to the girl, but I think it's all fine. I think she got over
They
that
agreed,
somehow.
Like, okay, we'll forgive you for this lie.
But I still got impressions that he really wanted Ernest too. That for me is.
You raise a good point. Both girls did want Ernest, and only one got that, actually.
Yeah.
That irritated me the most.
And it's kind of unclear at the end, but it's just like, and then they were all happy, I guess. Like the two couples and also Miss Prism with the doctor. We just assume like everyone's together. It's not really explicitly stated. We know the importance of being Ernest. End scene. You know.
Hold on a second.
Like, what?
But I have one positive thing to say about the ending. If it is a trivial comedy for serious people, and Oscar Wilde is actually saying serious people don't know anything because during the whole play, it's like they just talk nonsense. Does it not make sense that the ending makes no sense?
I don't think it makes Oscar Wilde's intention.
It makes no sense. No, come on. It's just the ending
is far-fetched.
Yes, but that's the point, isn't it? That it's just like, yeah, I mean, like, just like the whole play made no sense. It's borderline absurdist.
I can agree with the absurdism throughout.
Yeah.
But I like it. Yeah. I like the whole thing. I just thought the ending was a bit, well, everything's very convenient, maybe, which is fine. But then why does only one of them get Ernest, as you say? And then they don't really explain. And now, you know, the aunt then doesn't take away her protests about the marriages. She doesn't say, okay, and lay it out. Now you can marry him and now you can marry her, because it just kind of ends. You just have to assume that it was all fine, you know.
But that was more my beef with the play. But I thought it was great. It's such a fun play. And
oh, yeah.
It's amazing.
I mean, I think watching this, I would have a fantastic time laughing throughout the entire thing. It would definitely be a play I want to watch.
I think I would like to see it as well. Yeah.
For me, I guess it's just those nitpicks, so.
Yeah, totally. And again, it's all about, for me, there's a very dark side to it. I always find dark sides to these things that, and it depresses you guys. But I think the dark side is, it really is really, really cynical. It's very lighthearted, but extremely cynical. And Oscar Wilde is very cynical in his plays, not in his short stories for children. It's very different there, but I find. But this is like very kind of like, there, you know, he says it is a terrible thing for a man to find out. Jack says near the end, it is a terrible thing for a man to find out suddenly that all his life he has been speaking nothing but the truth.
Yes.
Can you forgive me? I can, for I feel that you're sure to change.
Because they don't want to speak the truth. They're just these two guys that go around with fake names getting into hijinks. We never really find out how bad their hijinks are, but they get into scripts, as they call it, and just, you know, go bumbering around.
Everyone really in the whole play is like, it's a good thing to be a bad person. And that's what, it's a good thing to have no morals. That's what.
But the worst thing we see anyone really do is eat the cucumber sandwiches and lie about it. Like, no one really does anything bad. They just,
that's a good point.
They lie about names, having brothers, people who don't exist, and then.
I suppose losing really a baby and then disappearing is not great.
There's really no stakes in this, which is fair.
Yeah, it's a totally no-stakes situation here. They end up getting married, presumably, and that's it. There's no real, there's nothing to be lost, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it is very farcical in the sense of that I would have thought that it might have it would have taken for the man more convincing. Because there's not much convincing, neither at the beginning.
Because they're lying. Yeah, like they say like marriage is this terrible thing we don't want, and then they're both already in love with a girl the first time they see them. You know, they're lying.
But this is what you loved, right? You love this kind of love story.
I have one concern though, because they mentioned that the ward is barely 18, and these are like men that we assume they're like 30, and he's like, "Well, would you?" They think at first that maybe Jack's in love with his own ward, and he's like, "Well, why would I be in love with my 18-year-old ward? That's inappropriate." And then his friend comes over and is like, "Oh yeah, I'm in love with her." And then he's like, "Oh, okay, that's."
I think it's only inappropriate because it's his ward rather than her being 18. I guess he also knew her as a baby.
I think Dean has a good point, and that's why I mentioned. I think the play, if you write down all the contradictions that are in the play, that because. My girlfriend, you know, your girlfriend's 18. Like, I can't be with an 18-year-old, and then the next day you get an 18-year-old girlfriend. I mean, they're always contradicting each other, and it's always like this society, this late Victorian society, is pointing the finger at someone, but actually you're doing the same thing.
That's very
true. Eating all the cucumber salads. You're taking the girl that's really underage. You're doing this. You're doing that. You're lying about their names. Yeah, exactly. And then eat some muffins, you know.
But they find out she's not going to be of age, so she's 35, according to the will. But they just say,
I'm pretty sure that's made up.
Would you not be prepared to wait 17 years? You've only just met her today and fallen in love, and she's 18. But would you not be prepared to wait until she doubles her age? You know, that's ridiculous.
Oh, Lord.
But we've covered it all, really.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to mention...
I just want to point out just from the textbook I'm using to read this, this is a bit of an absurd play. We can kind of agree. The next play in my book is Dadaist, which is just going even more insane. Alfred Jarry's Au Bourgeois, if you're very interested, but...
I
don't know. Actually.
Yeah, Dadaism. It's insane.
Well, you know, just to mention that a bit, Dadaism came 20 years later during the First World War, and the point of Dadaism is they got like a toilet and just turned around and called it a fountain. So it's really just turning it, you know, First World War, it's like everything's absurd. Nothing makes sense. Yeah. So
imagine doing LSD and watching random crap happen in like old silent movies.
Except they started that. Mm. So that's what makes them revolutionary. They started that, to be fair, in the First World War.
I guess we can conclude by saying that you had a couple of nitpicks at the ending, Alex, but overall, we all enjoyed the play, so that's good.
Yeah, it was a great play.
We'd recommend it. Play.
No debate.
And I highly recommend his other plays. And he's got some. He's got Salome as well. If you want to just read a pure tragedy of his, I mean, so he's got some interesting stuff. Oscar Wilde, though, is best at his children's short stories. That's where I say read those. So a small recommendation for you guys.
Okay.
And Dorian Gray, as Dean would recommend.
Dorian Gray, which is, of course, fantastic. And I aspire to be Dorian Gray.
Well, I hope not.
Well, look, I kind of do. So
where is that painting? Show it.
So next time we're going to try an Inspector Calls, maybe. I've been pitching that one for a while. So I think we can try that one next time.
Well, you've been going on about it for a while, so let's go.
I think you'd both like it, yeah. Maybe do it late October. Okay, guys, this has been Playboys. I normally have a Shakespearean day, but it's not Shakespeare, so have a weird day. Mix up your identity and pretend to be Ernest.
Well, have a wild
Have an Ernest day. Oh, there you go.
Oh, they both work! Have a wild yet Ernest day.
Have an important day. No.
Have an important, wild yet Ernest play. Make it trivial.
No.
We're done. That's too much.
Eat cucumber sandwiches and don't tell your aunt about it. Do that.
It's the real moral of the play, to be fair.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.